Here at Karis Bible College high in the Rocky Mountains. And greetings to all of you attending the conference via live stream from locations around the globe. Welcome to the Kingdom Business Summit 2019. Colorado is well known for its 53 14ers. That's 53 mountain summits over 14,000 feet in elevation in Colorado. People come from all over the world to hike these majestic peaks. There is nothing like planning, training, and then the arduous journey of reaching the summit of a 14er. The same is true in your business and career. If you are running a business or want to take your career to the next level, you are in the right place. We are going to train you, help you innovate with wisdom, and then activate you so you can immediately experience a new level of achievement as you journey towards your summit of success. You will be taught practical strategies and best practices at this summit. But perhaps even more valuable than skills is the supernatural impartation that you'll receive from each of the Christian leaders who are teaching the sessions. At this conference, you will learn how to work with the Lord as your guide. Let's agree together that at this summit, the Lord will speak to you. He will give you exactly what you need and release you into a greater level of success than you have ever experienced. Amen? On behalf of Andrew and Jamie Womack and all of the conference speakers, welcome to the Kingdom Business Summit 2019. Let's get started.
Well, guys, like the video said, welcome officially to the 2019 Kingdom Business Summit. I just found out the live stream is just beginning, so welcome to all of our live stream guests. So glad you guys can join us and be part of this incredible conference this weekend. This evening, we have an incredible opportunity to hear from two of the amazing speakers we've got lined up for us. But before we do, I'd like to call up Paul Milligan. He's the CEO of Andrew Womack Ministries and Karis Bible College, the director of the third-year Karis Business School, and also he has brought and built 16 companies. This is incredible, and we're so privileged to have him here. He's built 16 companies, the largest of those being an aerospace engineering company that is traded on the NASDAQ. That's incredible. So give it up for Paul Milligan.
Well, good evening. It's good to see you all here. Let me start out by giving a very special welcome to, in my opinion, the most important people in the house, and that's the partners and friends of Andrew Womack Ministries. If you're a partner of Andrew Womack Ministries, raise your hand, wave at me like this. Look at that. How many of you, this is the first time you've been in the new auditorium? What do you think about what you built? Is this incredible? Is this amazing? As most of you have probably heard Andrew talk about, you're setting in about $75 million worth of buildings that are already paid for. So listen, we give God the glory for that. It's amazing. In my life, I've seen many miracles, financial miracles. But this is the greatest one I've ever seen. And God just didn't do it for us. We need to use this as a testimony, as an inspiration for other ministries, for other organizations to be able to believe God for the provision that it was there to support their vision. Where God has established vision, He's gone ahead of that and already established provision. The way we get to provision is by believing God and not depending on the world system. You know what so many Christians do today, and it's just a mistake in the way we think financially. Our mindsets are wrong when it comes to money. But we see the incredible promises of God in His Word. How many of you have ever noticed them? How God has provided for us in His Word. God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you having all sufficiency in all things, but then have an abundance to give to every good work. Now, how many Christians are living that? All sufficiency in all things? Well, you know, most of our experience is some sufficiency in a few things every once in a while. All sufficiency in all things, but that doesn't satisfy God. He then wants us to have an abundance to give to every good work. And that's how an organization like Andrew Womack Ministries can meet its obligations and its operational expenses and build $75 million worth of buildings with the discretionary income that you gave this ministry. And we thank you for it. We do not take it for granted. You're prayed for. You're precious to this ministry. You're precious to Andrew and Jamie. You're talked about in this organization daily. We didn't do this. You did this. And so we thank you for that, and we welcome you to the Business Summit here this year. It's just fun to have our Business Summit in the new auditorium this year. And man, is this some facility or what? Is God good, or am I the only one that thinks that? Amen. Well, it's my privilege, and I don't want to take up a lot of time. It's my privilege tonight to introduce our speaker, Dr. Henry Cloud. And I have the bio here, and on one side is Dr. Cloud's bio, and on the other side is Willie Robertson's. And I didn't realize that. I turned it over a while ago, and I was thinking, well, I guess I better get familiar with Dr. Cloud. He's the CEO of Duck Commander and Buck Commander and star of A&E's Duck Dynasty. And I thought, wow, I didn't know that. That's incredible. So I better turn it over like this. Ah, here's Dr. Henry Cloud. You know, I feel like I know him. I've heard him twice today. We were down at the Broadmoor today with Ziklag, and he spoke there. And I grabbed some nuggets. This guy's, he's got an amazing ministry. Let me read you some things about him. Dr. Cloud is an acclaimed leadership expert, psychologist, and best-selling author. He is a frequent contributor to CNN, Fox News Channel, and other national media outlets. His experience includes 3 decades as a consultant and as an entrepreneur. He has started and grown a successful chain of treatment centers in over 40 cities across the Western United States. Dr. Cloud is a graduate of Southern Methodist University with a BS in psychology. He completed his PhD in clinical psychology at Biola University and his clinical internship at Los Angeles County Department of Mental Health. And I heard him say today he lives in Beverly Hills. That takes some mental health to live in Beverly Hills. So his philanthropic interests include homelessness in the inner city as well as missions in the developing world. He lives in Los Angeles with his wife, Tori, and their 2 daughters. Would you help me welcome Dr. Henry Cloud? Yeah, let's give him a charis welcome.
When I first started doing Duck Dynasty, you know, it wasn't a show. We just make duck calls. So we'd sit around home, go, quack, 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 like that. How's that? That's pretty good, right? I grew up in Mississippi duck hunting. So welcome. How many of you were not here in the session this afternoon? Okay, so I might... The other ones of you who were here, I'm going to refer back to a couple of things that I want them to get that you already got, so I'm going to say a couple of things twice for you, so if you can grant me that little grace. So I started by asking, why are y'all here at a business thing with a shrink? Like, what's wrong with you? And how many of you, how many of you got some issues? All right, that's good. Then you're in the right place. Because here's what I tell people. You know, I work mainly with CEOs and their teams and cultures. And we just, you know, we all have issues. Everybody's got issues. And here's the best way I can tell you to figure out if you got any or not. Look right down here and see if you got a belly button. Now go ahead and check. You got one? All right. If you got a belly button, what that means is that you did not come directly from the hand of God. There were 2 people who didn't have belly buttons, Adam and Eve. The rest of us came through, how many of you would say you're from a dysfunctional family? All right? Well, if you got a belly button, you are. It's called the human race, Adam's family. You know, it's crazy, right? Now, I start with that because what the Bible says is that ever since Genesis 3, all of us were created with God's image, but we went through this thing called the fall. And when we go through a fall, what happens is the image is still there, but we have to be adopted into this new family with a new birth to get that image restored. And what I've strongly come to believe in the area of leadership and business success and all of that is that the path to being successful, and you know, we see this all the time, and I'll talk about this a little bit more in a minute. The path to being successful has so much more to do with who you are than whatever your business plan or business acumen or any of that stuff is. Because every day, people with all sorts of great ideas find themselves in all sorts of great situations. But the difference in the ones that do really well is exactly what the Bible says. It's about the tree, and the tree has got to be healthy to produce the fruit. And so what we're going to do is we're going to spend a few minutes, and I want to talk a little bit about a model that I developed a long time ago about restoring this image. Some things that God has built into all of you that are capacities and capabilities that come from Him. And the degree to which we're growing in those is going to have everything to do with the degree to which you're successful. A number of years ago, a friend of mine who had two sons, they were kind of in college age and are about to get out of college and hit the work world and 21 years old or so. And she says, "Will you go talk to the boys about success?" And I said, "No, I don't want to do that." And she says, "Why not?" And I said, "Well, success really isn't my... call Zig Ziglar. You know, I don't do the success thing." She says, "Come on, you've known successful people. You work with them. You've done some stuff. They're 21 years old. Just go out there, take them to dinner and make up something." Because they're asking all these questions. So I said, "All right, I'll take them to dinner and I'll make up something about how to be successful." She goes, "What are you going to tell them?" I said, "I don't know. I got to make it up." She says, "Well, after you make it up, well, you know, what's it going to be?" And so I'm trying to get this psychotic mother out of my head. And I go, "All right, I'm going to tell her. This is exactly what I'm going to tell. Number one, boys, you can fake it for about a minute or a week. There's going to be three ingredients to this. First one is you got to get good at something. If you're going to be a leading surgeon, you got to know where the arm is." You know? Whatever. You've got to do your homework. You got to get good at something. But there are a lot of competent people that go out there, and what they do is they just do a job. And they do it well. But they don't become wildly successful, or what we call leaders. To do that, you got to have the second ingredient. The second ingredient is that you got to be able to build alliances. Take your competencies, take your gifts, and build alliances with other people who have competencies and gifts. And you put those two together, and that's how you leverage things bigger than just what you're good at. And if you're in business, that's got to be across the company. You have to make alliances with the other departments. You have to make alliances with sometimes regulators, investors. All, you know, that's what it's about. I said, but here's the deal. And here's what I want us here tonight, because this is what God says over and over and over. Business schools, seminaries, medical schools, MBA programs, they're churning out a gazillion of these every day. Really competent people that are great networkers and deal people. But what I said was, you got to have the third component. And that is, you got to have the character to not screw it up. Now, admittedly, that's kind of negative, because I'm a shrink and I'm a pooper scooper in life. I just go around helping. But the positive side of that is that our character, now I want to talk for just a minute about this character thing, and then I want to unpack it in some specific components. But this character thing, we totally don't get about what it is. If you do the sort of the Jay Leno or Letterman or who's out there now, Kimmel, or, you know, where they walk up to somebody on the street and they say, "Okay, where's the capital of the U.S.? And they go, "Boise?" You know, that sort of. If you ask the normal, take Christian, say, "What is character?" Normally what you're going to get is you're going to get an answer that basically the biggest thing you hear is, well, character means somebody has integrity. Well, then if you say, well, what is integrity? What they'll say is, well, you know, and there's a lot of definitions floating around there. But what they say is, well, if you have integrity, it means you're the same person in private you are in public. That's not integrity. That's a lack of duplicity. Okay? It's not. It's a part of integrity, but what that is you're not two people. And then you'll hear things, you know, it's about the character. But all of this stuff tends to get, and especially among evangelicals, character and integrity tend to get looked at as a moral construct. Like, you're a good guy. Or you're a good woman. Basically, you don't lie, cheat, or steal. You have integrity. Well, let me ask you a question. How many people do you know that are honest and moral and have integrity in that way? They don't lie, cheat, or steal, that you've worked with or had as a boss, and given the opportunity, you would never work with them again. Everybody know that person? So what is that? See, I want to call you tonight to a deeper understanding of integrity and character, and it's exactly the one that the Bible gives us. Integrity basically means to be whole. That's what it means. An integer is a whole number. It means to be complete. We have an aerospace engineer here, right? If isn't that what you did, sort of?
I wasn't one. I just managed them.
You just manage them. Well, then that means you have more than they do. All right. If I'm from Boeing and I'm going and talking to the Air Force, and the Air Force says, you know, we need you to build us a new jet, what's the first question the Boeing engineer is going to ask the Air Force? Well, what are you going to do with it? Right? What are you going to do with this plane? He says, well, if we're going to fly cargo to North Carolina, then I can make it of a certain kind of metal, certain kind of composite that has a certain kind of integrity to that material. But if the general says, we're going to fly this thing from 0 to 1,000 Mach, which is not a number. I said that at the Air Force Academy one day, and they looked at me like, who invited this idiot in here? But really fast, and roll it, and you know, extreme temperatures, that engineer goes, that's got to be made of different stuff. That plane has got to have a structural integrity to it that holds together in the face of the demands of reality that are going to be put upon it. All right? So I want to give you a definition of character that I think is what the Bible talks about. This character, this thing of integrity, wholeness. In fact, do you know what the word character means in the Bible? It's interesting. We throw it around all the time like we all know what it means. Do you know the word character only appears in the Bible about 4 or 5 times? It's not even there. And we throw it around like it's the whole program. It's really interesting. You see it in Romans 5, for example, proven character. Brings about hope and all, and you see it in different places. The word character in the Bible, the Greek word, here's what it means. It means experience. The English word for character is a word that means an engraved mark, like on a bracelet. See, just like you engrave something on a piece of metal, our experiences in life engrave things on us. That's why we raise children carefully. We're engraving, we're building experiences that are internalized that become structural integrity, structural abilities. And see, here's the problem with you and me. We've had experiences in life that have wounded some of our wings, some of our engines, some of the fuselage. We got dents in us. And those experiences have become part of our makeup, our character. And now we go into this career, and God's given us the promised land to go take. And we get up over the wall like the spies. Remember that story? And maybe you've been abused by lions and tigers and bears and stuff. And you look over the wall and God says, go take the promised land. And you look out there and you feel fear. maybe you have PTSD, and you hide, or you shrink back, or you have a voice inside that says, I'll never be good enough to capture what he has for me. And all this stuff lives in our head. But here's the good news of the gospel, that you are not a slave to the experiences that you've had in your life, because God has taken you out of Adam's family and put you into a new family. And in that new family, you're going to come to places like this, and you're going to have new experiences that are going to heal the old ones. And not only that, download a bunch of other stuff. So what I want to do is I'm going to give you like a, do I have a clock somewhere? Ah, up there. Okay, let's close in prayer. We're out. No, I'm kidding. I'm going to give you, and I refer you to the book this is from. It's a book I wrote called Integrity, the Courage. Integrity, subtitles, the courage to meet the demands of reality. Because that's what happens. See, you're this sort of like a boat, right? And this boat's got to have integrity, and it leaves a wake behind it of results and relationships. But what happens is you're going to go out there in your leadership, and you're going to hit a tsunami like a market downturn, or you're going to run out of money, or you're going to have a lawsuit. And the integrity of this boat, it's like that airplane. See, God has given you developmental experiences and mentors and coaches to build new things in you, so when you hit those waves, nothing bad happens. But if we don't have the healings inside that we need, or building up the cracks in some key areas, then that's where we bottom out. I've worked a lot with around and with Navy SEALs, and they have a saying. You know, you've heard the saying, boy, he really or she really rose to the challenge. The SEALs will tell you you're crazy. Here's what they say. Nobody rises to a challenge. You fall to your level of training. See, it's who we are. We get tested like a fishing line. You know, there's a limit, and they tested at a limit. Past that, it cracks. So what God is doing in your life to prepare you for the leadership and business and all of that that you're going to run is he is building things into you. Your level of development and training, and then you're going to hit a bad market condition. You're not going to rise to the challenge. You're just going to execute who you are and who he's made you. Some of you, just a handful, what I tried to do a long time ago was build a model that graduate schools and businesses and companies could use to look at some key areas. And this is going to go really fast because we don't have a lot of time. But I want to give you six areas of character development that I want you to focus on. And let me preface it with one more example why sometimes we don't see the full richness of what the scripture says here. I got called by a big Christian organization, by the president, to come help with, he said, I want you to come work with my executive team. And he said, I need some leadership development. And I said, okay, so I flew back there and we sit down. And I said, one of the first things I said was, you know, I work with a lot of big secular companies and I love to work every now and then with a Christian organization. Because I get to talk about the spiritual side of leadership. I thought the guy's hair was going to catch on fire. Actually, he didn't have hair, but if he had, it would have. And he said, wait a minute, wait. I didn't call you in here to do spiritual development. I said, well, we're doing leadership development. He said, I need leadership development. I said, well, they're kind of the same thing. He goes, no, they're not. He said, my executive, these are the godliest men I know. I have walked with these men. These are godly men. They don't need spiritual development. And I'm going, whoa. Okay, well, what kind of leadership problems are you having? He said, well, we have a big mission here. And he says, I just can't get them like to work together. They have their own departments inside, and they protect their budgets. And they won't share information. I can't get them to the transcendent purpose where they're all about their own thing. And I said, so these are the godly men? He goes, yeah, they're God, you know, that steeple voice, they're godly men. I said, well, you know, my Bible says that love doesn't seek its own. I said, maybe they got a little spiritual development for their leadership development. I said, in fact, let's see what the Bible says about this character trait thing. Went to 2 Peter 1 and I read him that passage where it says, basically, if you're going to be fruitful, that these character traits have to be present and increasing in you. And one of them, it starts with moral excellence. That's the ethical part. That's the foundation. Lying, cheating, stealing doesn't work. But then it goes on to knowledge. And are they building the knowledge base that they need? And then it goes on to perseverance. And then it says mutual affection. I said, I don't hear a lot of what Peter refers to as mutual affection going on in your team. And in John 17, Jesus didn't pray for the finances in the strategic plan. He prayed for their mutual affection. He prayed for their oneness, for their unity. The only time I've ever seen God talk about being scared, if you will. I know there's problems with that statement. When did he get scared? Remember when he got scared? He got scared of something? At the Tower of Babel, he said, these humans, they all speak the same language. In other words, they're one. They have unity. And if they're united, they can do anything they want. We got to scatter their language. And then he takes that same powerful dynamic of that unity over in John 17. And this time he prays for it to happen. He doesn't break it up because he wants them connected because they can accomplish anything. See, that team, they were godly men, right? In my view, probably, yes. But they were more religious than they were whole. And there's a big difference in being religious and being whole. So let's talk about just a couple of these things about wholeness. Number one, everything is built on trust. The first character quality of wholeness that makes for success is the ability of a leader to create and to maintain trust. It is the most important element in all of the universe. Why? Why do I say that? Because we are not God. We're not the creator. We are the created creature. So that's a big problem. God is the only self-sustaining person, entity in the universe. And that means that the rest of us draw life from outside of ourselves. Everything we get, the Bible says, was given to us from the outside. Now, if I'm going to get some stuff from the outside, I got to be able to trust, and I got to be somebody that people can trust. Because basically, let me give you the formula. Trust fuels investment. Trust fuels investment. If you're going to build a team when you go do your business, you don't want people on that team half in and half out. Have you ever been on a team where somebody's not 2 feet in, or in a marriage where somebody's not both feet in? See, when trust is broken down for whatever reason, they're hesitant. Right now, you're trusting the air in this place. And you know what you're doing? You're investing. You're taking it in. If you started to smell some fumes, you wouldn't breathe so deeply. In fact, you might even hold your breath and be very careful. You might even run out of the room. Trust fuels investment. You are going to, if you're going to succeed in business, your customers must trust you. You must build a company that the community trusts. And if they do, they will invest in you. And I'm not talking about just capital. I'm talking about they'll give, you're in the home security business, they'll invest in having your alarm system protect their home. They'll invest in your being their financial advisor or their insurance agent or whatever it is. But it's only going to come through that trust. So I want to give you just one character piece, one character trait that drives that basic trust, and it's this. It's your ability to connect with whoever it is that you're wanting to trust you. And basically, human connection at its deepest level is based on something called understanding or empathy. I'm going to illustrate this for a second. Back in 92, how many of you were alive in 92? Remember the presidential election? You got Bush the senior, and you got this other no name that nobody had heard of from Arkansas. And Bush is out there, and he's in a grocery store, and they put a microphone up to him, and they said, on the TV cameras, how much is a gallon of milk? And he goes, gosh, I don't know. I hadn't bought milk in a long time. I don't know, $4 or $5? The next day, all the smear campaigns, the ads, the political ads from the other side, he doesn't understand your life. He lives in an ivory tower. He's wealthy and removed from it all. He doesn't know what you struggle with. It's the economy, stupid. And you see all of this. And Bush was actually a very connecting man. He was a very loving, a good guy. But they just had a snippet of where it looked like he doesn't understand your life. Meanwhile, the governor of Arkansas, Clinton, nobody had heard of him. He's going around having town hall meetings. And he said one thing over and over and over, over and over and over. Remember what it was? I feel your pain. I feel your pain. I feel your pain. And he kept saying that over and over and over and over and over. And people said, he feels my pain. He understands me. And they moved towards. They breathed it in. Basic human trust. I was doing a merger one time, or a consultant on a merger with a healthcare company and two healthcare companies, and they came together, and it was that morning where the CEO cast the vision for the new leadership team of both companies. And he cast a vision. It was incredible. I was ready to go to work for him. It was like I was going, I want to join. You guys are going to conquer. I mean, it was amazing. Until he opens it up to questions. Lady over here raises her hand. She goes, yeah, I lead about 3,000 people. I've moved people all over the country based on our one product line. I've upended careers. And now the other company, she points to the other side of the room, the other company has the same product line. And my people are worried, sick, what's going to happen to us? And the CEO looks at her and he says, well, tell them, they don't have to worry about that. And he kind of says it's not going to be a problem because, and I can't remember his reasons. But he basically explained to her what reality was. Now, see, he would tell you that he understood. And so he gave her his understanding. But I'm a shrink. I'm watching her eyes, and I'm seeing the lights dimming because he didn't connect with her before he tried to persuade her. Man over here raises his hand. He says, yeah, I'm director of sales at our company, and we've always sold to hospitals and clinics and providers, and the new model is about, you know, third-party payers, insurance companies, institutions. How long is it going to take, do you feel like, and how are we going to morph our whole sales army over to this new business model? And he basically says, well, that's not going to be a problem because it's going to sell itself. And he explained reality to him. Well, he does this two or three more times. We walk out the door. And he turns to me, and in classic leader persuader style, he looks at me with all that fervor, and he goes, wasn't that fantastic? And I looked at him, and I said, no. It's like the worst thing I've ever sat through. It was like a funeral. He said, what are you talking about? I said, you did not connect with one place where they were. He said, of course I did. I said, no, you didn't. In fact, every time they tried to tell you something about their life or where they were or what they're, you know, every time they tried to tell you, you immediately invalidated what they were saying and told them your reality. He said, no, I didn't. I said, shut up. You're doing it to me. A year later, he was gone. He never could capture the trust of the people. And he had the competency and the alliances. But see, the makeup of who he was got in the way. I want you to look at, you know, sometimes we have to grow emotionally to be able to get out of our own detachment and enter in empathically to understand what our people are going through. To hear their complaints without getting defensive. All of that stuff. I want you to look at this basic empathy that builds trust. And guess what? It was God's way to win you and me back. See, he came off the hill with the 10 persuasive arguments. And Paul says in Romans that he brought the law and it was weak and it couldn't do anything. But what he said he did was the great kenosis passage of Philippians where it says he emptied himself of all the know-it-all stuff, the God stuff. And he took on human flesh and he got down to our level. And Hebrews says we don't have a priest who can't sympathize with our weaknesses but knows what it's like to have your job threatened, to buy milk, to have to morph a sales army. And whenever you're going to lead, when your customers and your people know that you know, that's the essence of incarnational trust. And everything that God has designed in human beings begs for that kind of deep understanding. Number two, oriented towards the truth. Okay, we said you can't be lying, cheating, and stealing, but what does this mean? Basically, it means this. Not lying, cheating, and stealing, that's kind of like truth 101. But when my daughters were 5 years old, they knew what lying, cheating, and stealing was, and not to do that. They weren't ready to run a business. Oriented towards the truth, and these are the most successful people, they can't stand to not feel like they know what reality is. They're looking for reality. Their North Star, the compass, is always seeking. I got to know what's real. And they build their companies. They just can't not do it. They build feedback systems to know what reality is. They're looking for the truth of where their customers are. A friend of mine was a global head of marketing for Procter & Gamble. And he had great success in China and Japan, or Japan and Australia. They moved into China. They had no business there back when this started. Started the business from scratch, take it to a couple of billion real quickly. And they asked him one day, I said, Dennis, how'd you do this? He said, well, I moved to China and I got a job on a rice farm. I said, well, how'd that help? You're selling, what does P&G make, Tide or Cheer or something? You're selling laundry detergent and Crest, toothpaste. You got to work on a rice farm. Well, how's that going to help you? He says, well, I didn't know how they lived. I didn't know, you know, how do they do laundry? I said, well, don't you just pour the soap in and hit play? I mean, how hard is this? He says, well, do they do it once a week or do they? And he said, I lived with them for a month or two, and I found there's a water pressure problem in China and a water hardness problem, and they can't get bubbles at home. So I found out that truth because, see, he hungered for what's reality. What am I really standing on? You see the Bible, they always send out the spies. And they're always searching for what's underneath this and what's right. They're always, there's this drive to, don't give me a bunch of happy talk. Give me what's real. And they're not afraid of it. So what he did was he took that truth back to Cincinnati to the guys in the white coats and said, give me bubbles and soft water and low water pressure. And they put an enzyme in there
took it back to China, and they ran ads all over the country. Bubbles at home. And they killed it. When Rick Warren started Saddleback, he's in seminary in Fort Worth. And God tells him to go start a church in Saddleback, California. You can read about this story. He didn't know anything about Saddleback, California. He didn't even know where it was. And this is before you could Google this stuff. He goes in the basement doing research at the library for 6 months, researching the people in Saddleback, California to find out what's the truth. What kind of political persuasions do they have? How far do they drive away from home on a given week? What are their entertainment options? What kind of jobs do they have? How much money do they make? Where do send their kids to school? What kind of music do they listen to? He said at the end of 6 months, he knew more truth about the people in Saddleback, California than they knew about themselves. So then he moves to California to start the church. Now you would think a seminary graduate, early 80s, I think, they all know how to start churches, right? You get a guitar, rent a gym, start a church. They've done this. He didn't do that. You know what he did? He went there, put an army together, went and knocked on doors throughout Saddleback and called people and asked one question. Do you go to church? And if they said yes, they said, God bless you. Have a nice day. If they said no, they asked the second question, why not? And then when the people told them why not, they wrote down all those answers. Because now they're finding out what reality is about why these people don't go to church. And then the mission became, let's build a church that has none of those reasons. See, the Bible talks about character, and part of character is something that the Hebrew calls the know-it-all syndrome. I think it's called pride. See, humble people, they're not self-deprecating. They just know they don't know everything. And you know what that allows you to do? It allows you to be curious. It also allows you to put people that are much smarter than you around you, which is the only way to succeed in anything anyway. But some people know it all. I remember a guy way back when the internet first started, and I put an old AOL address on my business card because I was an early adopter. And he was the president of the company, we're in an elevator. He says, let me see your business card. I need your business. I gave him my business card. He looks at it. He goes, is that an internet address? Because this is before internet had caught on. He says, why do you have your email address on your business card? I said, because everything I've been studying says that people are going to start doing business using email. I said, some stuff I've been reading says that they're going to do that even more than faxes. You know what he said? He started laughing. He said, that'll never happen. Well, see, he had something called cognitive rigidity. He couldn't assimilate and accommodate new input. Assimilate means you're non-defensive and open-minded enough to take the data in. Accommodate it means once you get the data, now you got to make room for that in your little worldview that's got to get bigger. And we'll never see the truth of what can be if we don't have the humility of character to be able to let it in. If I ask you the question, where did Google come from? What would you say? I mean, there's a lot of things we could say. But you know where I think it actually came from? It came from something very similar to what you're doing at this conference. A graduate student named Larry Page was in Michigan. He went to a business leadership development exercise camp experience. And they started tweaking with his head. And they got a mantra into his head that they made him think about all the time. And this was the mantra he had to think about. Have a healthy disregard for the impossible. Meaning, whatever you start to think about, just because it's impossible, disregard the fact that it's impossible. So he started thinking this way.
A few weeks later, a month or soon thereafter, I think it was weeks, he wakes up one morning and a thought comes into his mind. And here was the thought. What if we downloaded all of the URLs on the whole internet and kept the links, saved the links? What if we, in effect, downloaded the entire internet and kept the links? What could we do with that? See, there were no search engines. Think about that. I mean, if I thought of that, I would take Alka-Seltzer and go back to sleep. But now he's got to have a healthy disregard for the impossible. So he says, what if we do this? Think of what we'd go through here. We don't have enough RAM to start. My computer's not big enough. Where am I going to? See, we're not going to be open to the realities of what's possible unless we're open. And unless we're looking. And that's a character thing. Probably not going to make it through six of these, but I'm going to give you another one. It's the flip side of this one. Embrace negative reality. See, the looking for the truth, that's opportunity, that's what's reality. You know, can we download the internet? Can we, you know, make soft water, give bubbles? But here's a problem with humans and our character. We don't like this. Let me go further than that. We hate negative realities. We experience them as adversarial. And there's a deep theological reason for that. We don't have the grace to handle them. You know, you and I were designed to be perfect. And we're designed to be perfect people in relationships with other perfect people. Turn to the person you came with and say, sorry, you got me instead. Right? And you were designed to be in a perfect environment, a perfect world, a perfect business, a perfect market condition. And then what happens is you see the disconnection from the God of grace and relationship that enables us to metabolize anything. And when we lost relationship with him, the immediate thing that happened was they covered themselves out of shame. Ever since then, humans have been divided into a couple of camps. And I'll give you two of them. The Proverbs talks about over and over and over about this character trait, the wise and the fool. And what it says about a wise person is they are known by not how smart they are, but what they do when a negative reality comes towards them. It says, correct a wise person and he will love you for it. Correct a wise person and they will become wiser still. In other words, we got problems. Come tell me about the problems. And I'll learn. And I'll listen. I'll take them in. And so what does God do with wise people who can listen to feedback and take correction? It says, correct this person. They'll listen. And then they get better. What does God do with a person like that? You give them problems, and they solve those problems, and they grow, and they get better. What does he do? He gives them bigger problems. Don't you want bigger problems? When my girls were two, their biggest problem was, you know, can I get the food in my mouth or not spill the milk? Wouldn't you love to have a bigger problem with that? Wouldn't you love to say, I got to get a tax accountant. What am I going to do with all these millions in income and the taxes I got to pay? That's a great problem. But you're not going to get there if you hadn't been able to embrace the little problems along the way. And see what defensive and arrogant people do, the fools. It says correct a fool and they'll hate you for it. They'll get defensive. They'll cast insults upon you. And here's what you're going to learn. In fact, marriage research shows this. Do you know the Gottman's research, for example? They can take a couple and give them something to talk about, finances or kids or whatever, and watch them for 15 minutes, and predict, just by watching the couple talk, a married couple, predict with a 93% accuracy whether or not that couple will be divorced in 7 years. You know how they do it? They're looking for four behaviors. And basically, they're the behaviors of the fool that Proverbs teaches about. They're looking for defensiveness. You confront me or say something, I get defensive, I don't embrace it. They're looking for judgmentalism, which is how we embrace other people's failures. Are we judgmental or are we helpful? They're looking for contempt. It's the hatred of people that don't serve us well. If there's a problem in a relationship, we make them bad in some way. And they're looking for something they call stonewalling or unplugging. And that's when you talk to me about a problem, I roll my eyes or I walk out the door. I did a hospital deal one time, and I walked in the war room of this public company, and I'll never forget, it was the first deal I'd ever done with a public company. I thought, these are the adults. I was in my 20s. And they had this big sign across the back of the room, the war room, and here's what it said. No problems, dot, 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 no profits. No problems, no profits. Every day that you're in business, you're going to wake up and solve some problem. It's going to be with a person, yourself, the market, the product, or a new opportunity of how do I download the whole internet? That's a problem. But when it comes back that we're not good enough or failing or something like that, you run to that info. I don't mean that you have to wallow. You know, if somebody's saying something crazy, they're calling you a horse, tell them to shut up. But if five people call you a horse, go buy a saddle. We got to be able to take feedback. And you know how you're going to do that? Because you're not in the Adams family anymore where you got to cover up and you're ashamed. You are in the Beloved. And you've surrounded yourself with the Beloved family that loves you like you are and are committed to making you better. Then we can move towards any virus we got and we can solve it. So I'd like to go on and on about this. You can check it out in the book Integrity. We're out of time. I want to give you one link that, thank you, Google. If you go to leadyou.tv, I've got an online kind of coaching program for people in business. That it's fun. It's not a degree program. It's just stuff that can help you in a lot of the areas I've been talking about and a bunch of other ones. So check it out. It's fun. I'd love to join you in that. And I just want to take 1 second. Can I pray for everyone? Okay. And I'd like to pray for you. Father, I thank you for all these people that have come here to business gathering, a business summit. And God, I want to pray, first of all, that you would open their eyes, because they live in a culture, they live in a Christian culture that sometimes thinks business is somehow second tier to those who are in, quote, full-time ministry. God, I would like for you to show them in a million ways what the word ministry actually means. It means service. And God, that you have given these people services in their talents and gifts to go provide and subdue and rule and take care of the needs of this creation. Groceries for people, medicine for people, finances for people, roofs over their heads, whatever they're into, God, help them see those things as a gifting from you. And I pray that you multiply those gifts throughout this room. But first of all, let them see those as their calling. And I would remind all of you that there was only one little group of all those children of Israel that were in the professional ministry. You got the Levites, and God bless them, but everybody else had to go to work. And God, I pray that you give them the realization that their calling in business is a calling from you. And multiply them and prosper them. Grow them up and equip them. Protect them and lead them. In Jesus' name. Thank you guys for that.
Well, guys, another incredible session. Thank you, Dr. Cloud. We're going to take a short break, come back, and hear from Andrew Womack. But first, I want to do something kind of fun. We're going to do this throughout the sessions this weekend. But you notice this backdrop that's up here? We're going to have some fun trivia. How many of you are from Colorado or live in Colorado? Okay, so about half. So those of you who are not, you're going to learn some fun facts about Colorado this weekend. How does that sound? So this mountain here is one of the 14ers in Colorado. 14ers meaning 14,000 feet or above. Does anyone know, and maybe you might win a prize if you know this, what mountain this is? Come on, shout it out. I heard it over here. Mount Massive. This is Mount Massive. So fun fact, this is the second highest peak, even though it's called Massive. It's the second highest peak in the Rocky Mountains. And there was this thing that happened during the Great Depression where Mount Elbert, which is technically the highest peak in Colorado, there was people who were kind of voting that Mount Elbert was the tallest and people who were voting that Mount Massive was the tallest. And so they built a big pile of rocks on this thing just so it could get 12 feet taller so that it could be the biggest mountain in Colorado. Isn't that interesting? But anyways, Mount Massive is correct. I'm going to give you your gift. And please take a 15-minute break. Use the restrooms. Use the cafe. Use the resources. When you start to hear music, come on back in. That's the beginning of the next session.